Hey there, welcome along to the final Olympic special from the High Performance Podcast in association with Lotus. And you have not heard a conversation like this with anyone on the podcast so far. I guess there are small snippets you're going to hear which you can relate to others, but I don't think any athlete has come on this podcast and spoken quite like this since we started. It was an absolute pleasure to speak to this young lady. Today, we're in conversation with Johanna Konta.
I like talking. I like sharing my experiences. I've been very open in the work that I've done with Juan, with you know, people in the past, especially on the mental side. And I think I don't have any hang-ups about sharing. Pain times resistance equals suffering. So if I'm in pain, let's say at a 10, but and I'm, you know, resisting at a 10, my suffering's going to be 100. Yeah. But if my resistance is zero, then my suffering's zero. I don't like it when I think, you know, you hear these hyperbolic words of like, kind of, they've completely lost control, they're, you know, they're out of it, or, you know, let things happen, let things move. But for sure, for me personally, I needed to find a space where I could channel and could start reorganizing my thoughts when I became stressed or when I became so-called emotional.
I think what's really important to mention at this point, of course, is that Johanna Konta didn't go to the Olympics because she sadly tested positive for coronavirus just a few weeks before the games started. And I guess we all live a life where we're constantly basing our opinions of ourselves on our work performances or external factors and external successes. And if I'd have seen most athletes mention that one of the biggest moments of their careers wasn't going to happen just a few weeks before they were scheduled to do it, I'd have been really worried for them. But as you'll hear in this conversation with Johanna Konta, she has spent a long time working really hard to get herself into a space mentally where she really can accept anything that happens to her. And you're going to hear why, and you're going to hear the tools that she's managed to attach to herself to do that. But it's also a reminder that the sports people that we talk to exist in this world of highs and lows. And whether it's Johnny Wilkinson on this podcast saying that winning the Rugby World Cup is no more important than the washing up, because if it was, no longer being a rugby player would mean that he's less of a man. Or whether it's the Arsenal defender Hector Bellerin coming on the podcast and saying you have to be like a candle, so whether the world is up or down around you, your flame is steady. It's a reminder that Johanna Konta has to be exactly the same, because it was a real blow for her that she wasn't able to go to the Tokyo 2020 Games. When we sat down to have this conversation with her, she was all set and ready to go. But no one really knows quite what's around the corner for any of us. And it takes us back to that same old conversation about being process orientated, not outcome orientated. So Johanna Konta knows that she still did everything that she could to make 2021 a year to remember. But when it came to the Olympics, it just wasn't to be. Anyway, as you know, without Lotus cars, these Olympic specials wouldn't be happening. And I just want to put on record to say to Lotus, not just for the bike they designed for Team GB that powered us to so many gold medals, but for the fact that they wanted us to do these Olympic specials purely to have really in-depth conversations with Olympians so that you at home for free could hear this podcast and take those lessons. I think Lotus deserve huge credit for that. So thank you very much to Lotus for their continued support of High Performance. You can find them at Lotus Cars across social media. But right now, let's get straight on with it. It's time for another and the final Olympic special in association with Lotus Cars from the High Performance Podcast. Enjoy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to the overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Boy.
Joining us today, a woman who operates daily among the elite, the best in Britain at what she does, and a product of a life of sacrifice and commitment. But what made her focus with such clarity on her goals as a child? How were her early years shaped by leaving her parents to focus on her chosen sport? What have psychologists added to her armoury? And when times are tough, what gets her through? It's an absolute pleasure to welcome to the High Performance Podcast, Johanna Konter. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's quite the intro. It makes me quite nervous.
Oh, you'll be fine. Listen, you've had much more nerve-wracking things than a high-performance podcast interview over the years. So let's get going then. And our first question always is, what is high performance?
In my mind, high performance is finding your own 1%. It's finding your own, the best that you can be within yourself. And that's regardless. So it's basically your own PB, really. It's regardless of who you're competing against, what your job is, what your passions are. It's kind of honing in on your elite self. And I think elite doesn't just apply to sportsmen and women. It applies to every walk of life, depending on what you do.
I love the conversation about the extra 1%, because it kind of reminds me that so many people go around thinking they're giving it their all, but they haven't been opened up to this sort of extra 1%. Can you remember when you realised there was more to come, the difference between good and elite, the difference between the 1% and the non-1%ers?
I think it's finding that combination between working hard but also working right. I've always been a hard worker. I've always understood that I needed to sacrifice, I needed to dedicate myself to what I do and give it my all to give, you know, to have the best shot at succeeding. But I think sometimes with hard work can come tensity, and you can become a bit paralyzed, you can become a bit more stressed. And I think it's almost then understanding that you're doing the best that you can, but almost adding a bit of relaxation into there. And I think that's when you start opening yourself up to working the right way, both hard and applying yourself, but being productive and actually, I think, starting to build on what you build on to be successful.
Now, you said really casually there, Joe, that I've always known that you have to work hard, you have to commit, as if that's obvious to you, but for a lot of people it isn't. So how did you come to that realization?
I think I was maybe quite fortunate with my upbringing. My dad's a bit of a workhorse, and for as long as I can remember, my dad's worked in the hospitality business, and their, you know, holidays are not that simple. They're every Christmas, every Easter, every holiday he was working long shifts, long hours. And so you know, we'd get up extra early in the morning because I'd go with him to work before he then dropped me off at school. So I saw the kind of life that he lived, and it was nonstop and it was hard work. And so I think I was maybe exposed to that quite early on. So when tennis came into the picture, or my passion for tennis, I think I saw that as the blueprint for how I apply myself to what I do then. I think maybe, dad was a bit of an influence on that.
I'm sure I read somewhere that you were about 9 years old, 8 or 9 years old, and yes, you decided, I'm just going to be the world number one tennis player.
Yes.
That's quite yes, a goal to set yourself at quite a young age. Like,
yeah.
My daughter's still not sure what she's going to be doing. Talk us through that. That's amazing.
I started playing, about 8 years old. I was 7, 8 years old, and I started playing because the school that I went to had after-school care. There's a club right next door. They picked a group of us kids up, took us there. Mum and dad both worked full-time, got babysat for, a couple hours, and during that period I started playing. I did enjoy it then, so I didn't like it, and to this day when I ask mum and dad about it, they sometimes say, I would ask, do I have to go play? And they'd always say, well, no, but you'll need to go do something else. Sport was always a big part of our family, and it was something that they wanted me to do for a hobby, for physical education. Right. So that was staying. I somehow still ended up going to play. But then mum and dad entered me into some weekend competitions, like kind of at the club where I was practicing. Right. And then I started to play and compete. And that's when I fell in love with it. And that's when I became hungry for it and kind of, oh, this is really good. And then I think I've lost my train of thought there. What was your question?
Well, you're exactly on it. I mean, I was saying, where did it come from? It sounds to me like what you're saying is it wasn't the playing tennis that thrilled
you. No, it was
the
competing.
The competing.
Mm.
That is interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely, because it was, I think, what gave it purpose for me. I think for me, training without purpose is a bit boring, tiring. Training's hard. It's painful. It's exhausting. And I'm not one of those people that necessarily might do it just for laughs, really. So I think it gave that purpose of, I now need to go practice because I want to be better. And then suddenly, became conversation around, dad was like, okay, well, if you want to, become good, then we need to go train. And I was like, okay, we'll go running every morning, 5 a.m., let's go running. And so before he'd go to work and then drop me off at school, we'd always then start running.
And that was you driving that? Was nurturing it, but that was you setting that 5
o'clock? Dad was completely on board. I think I'm the son my dad never had, so he was fully on board with like me being all active and loving sport. So, funny story though, at the start of our runs, there was this little hill.
Yeah.
And we'd always go around a big golf course. This was when we were living in Sydney.
And how old are you now?
9, 10.
And how often is this happening?
Every morning, probably 5 times a week.
Brilliant.
Yeah, like school mornings.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure every morning.
Time of the day?
5 a.m. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about getting our kids out of bed for school.
I'm loving it.
Wow.
Okay. But we're running up this little hill, and I remember dad always used to like, okay, we'll race up the hill. And I was like, okay. And I'd sometimes win, I'd sometimes lose, but I was like running so hard. Only now, maybe a couple years ago, was I thinking of that. And I asked my dad, I'm like, there's no way a 10-year-old girl beats her like 30-something, 40-something-year-old dad at sprints up a hill. I'm like, did you let me win? He's like, of course. I'm like, I'm so betrayed. I'm like, my whole life's been a lie. I still to this day think of that, thinking, why did I think for a moment that actually a 10-year-old girl can beat her dad? And I really did.
What were you thinking at 5 to 5 in the morning when you're having to climb out of bed? Like, what was the end of goal at that point? Was it because you, as you said, you don't enjoy training, so it wasn't going for the run that was like, woohoo.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't remember. All I remember now as an adult is those are some of the best memories of my childhood. We'd always set the goal of running to the top of that golf course for sunrise. And for me, just having that kind of father-daughter time, spending that time with my dad, running, just that physical exertion, beautiful kind of sunrise, like something to aim for up there. It's honestly, it's some of my most fond childhood memories.
What was it that was lit in you? Was it the idea of beating other people or beating yourself that really lit a fire?
To be honest, I don't know. I don't know. And I just remember even now, kind of again, as an adult, thinking back on what that felt like to compete. I just remember being on court on, you know, these synthetic grass courts with like the sand on top. That's what I started to learn on. And I just see myself playing these matches and trying hard. And at that point, I didn't understand the difference between trying hard and trying right kind of thing. Yeah. And I just remember just wanting to win and wanting to, yeah, probably beat the other person and come out the victor. I think that's what fueled me.
And what were your parents like if ever you said, oh, do you know what, I don't fancy getting up today, I don't fancy training today, I don't really want to take part in this weekend's tennis tournament?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, there were a couple times when I was a young girl, actually, where I didn't want to do it. And I remember, I distinctly remember one competition, and I must have been, I'd say maybe 10 or 11. And the night before, I'd been at a friend's house. I had a sleepover, and during the day, I was playing in the pool and stuff, and I think I was quite tired. And they were the ones that were taking me to this tournament, and my dad was going to come collect me at the end. And for whatever reason, I don't know, I can't remember, maybe because I was nervous about the match, maybe because I was tired, a combination of the two, I went on court and I basically gave up the match. I said I felt ill. I said I had a stomach ache. And I remember my dad turned up. He took one look at me as like, you have no stomach ache, then you're done. Like, we'll stop playing right here. Because, you know, you don't just give up. You don't just, for no. So, and he, yeah, we got in the car, went home. I think he put my rackets away and I cried. I cried, I think, to me, it feels like days and days, probably weeks. It was probably like maybe an afternoon. I don't know. But for me, it was like world ending.
Yeah.
And I think I must have done convincing on my dad and must have just like, please, please give me another chance. So obviously I started playing again. I don't remember that part, but I just remember that moment when I was a young girl on giving up and why I should never give up and why I should never just throw in the towel and kind of leave.
And how vivid is that memory even now when you're playing on court at Wimbledon or in New York? How vivid does that memory still...
It's not at the forefront of my mind. I understand the value and I know what it means to be struggling out there, but I also know what good things can come in just staying there. So whether it's going right or wrong, just staying there, knowing things aren't permanent, knowing feeling stress or feeling anxiety or happiness or joy, anything, it's not permanent. Nothing's a permanent state. So I think that as an adult, I think probably comes from, you know, learning that lesson of not giving in the towel because you never know what can happen when you stay there. That was probably a shaping experience.
Definitely.
So there's a fascinating line that you, again, you use there where you spoke about trying hard and then trying smart.
Mm.
So what age was it that you made that distinction in terms of if you were going to commit to tennis and competing and progressing? What age did you realise that you were going to have to go all in?
I think I realised that very early on about going all in. I think when I was about 8-9 years old, I decided, you know what, I love this. I want to be number one in the world. I want to win all 4 Grand Slams twice and I want to win a gold medal. Like,
and were you just encouraged at home? Great, go for that.
Yeah, I think I was encouraged to dream. I was encouraged to imagine something big for myself. But I was encouraged to do that through understanding that I would need to put in the work to be able to achieve that.
Yeah.
So it was never just dream about it and, you know, it'll come and it'll be practical steps I'd need to take to be the best that I can be.
But I think you need the dream in the first place. I think too many people, either with their kids or on their own, they don't allow themselves to have that big dream. And I reckon without dreaming of being world number one or dreaming of, you know, winning a Grand Slam or whatever, you probably wouldn't do it. You wouldn't have got here without the dream.
Well, no, but I think it is dreams that actually I think also give us a roadmap essentially for what our passions are. It's what do you see yourself doing? What do you imagine? And it can change. It's not everyone who dreams of being an astronaut becomes an astronaut and things evolve, but it gives you ideas. And I think that's what you, from childhood, you kind of take into adult life of, okay, what are my passions? What kind of brings light into my life? I think dreams are very important.
So how important is perseverance then to go with those dreams? Because no tennis player gets to where you have in a linear way. There's low times as well. So can you talk to us about perseverance?
Oh, perseverance. I mean, I think perseverance is I would say generally an asset, but I think sometimes it's also doesn't help as well, depending on kind of where you are in your career. For me, I persevered, I'd say 95% of the time, because I knew that this was what I was meant to do, mm-hmm. and what I was destined to do, born to do, kind of, I was going to make it. But then 5%, I think, is persevering because you don't know what else to do.
Yep.
You don't know what life is outside what you've done for the last 10, 15, 20 years. So I think you don't always choose perseverance. I do think sometimes it chooses you, or it's easier to just stay and just keep doing it. I think that's probably perseverance. I mean, it's not that inspiring. It's a bit depressing.
But so, it's vital, though, isn't it?
Yeah. So how do you come now to realise that sometimes you might be flogging a dead horse, or you might be persevering on the wrong endeavour or the wrong task? Basically, how do you make that distinction?
I think through time and experience. I think through my career, especially until I became kind of what is, I guess, in mainstream known as successful in 2015, I mean, I had every reason to quit. I mean, I was in 2015, I was turning 24 years old. I'd made it a little bit to about 80, but I was generally ranked between 100 and 200, about around the 150 mark. I wasn't making a living. There was, I guess, no big reason for me to keep going.
Yep.
So I think there it was I think more the dream,
yeah,
and more the perseverance.
How close
together.
Did you come to knocking it all on the head?
Not close, just because every time it came into question of, okay, should I stop, or I don't actually always didn't even come into question, because I remember distinctly crying on my bed with my mum there. And I mean, it sounds so embarrassing to say, but I just remember just telling her, like, I just know that I'm meant to be famous. I just know that I'm meant to be known and be one of the best at what I do. And I just, it was like, I think that child was probably crying as an adult of like, yeah, why isn't that happening for me? So it never actually was an option for me within myself.
And what did your mum say in that conversation?
I can't remember.
Right.
I can't remember.
Sobbing.
I think I was too busy just crying. Yeah, literally, I can't remember. I think.
But generally, were you encouraged, or was there anyone ever saying to you, well, maybe you should start thinking about, you're 24 now, maybe life beyond tennis?
No, I'd say I was always encouraged. I'd say I was encouraged to decide for myself, I think. Yeah, I definitely was never told to keep going or told to stop. I think it was always there of, what do you want to do? And so I just kept trying.
And do you think you were upset because you were trying to live up to the expectation that that 8-year-old girl had of, you're going to be world number one and lift all these trophies, and there you are at 24 and it hasn't happened?
I think not so much about the dream. I think by then the dream is also muddled with all the sacrifices that comes along the way, not just my own, my parents. My parents left their lives in Australia. Mm. They racked up a load of debt moving over during the financial crisis while they both lost their jobs. Like, it was a whole family dynamic of sacrifice, and knowing that, having, for me, I felt personally responsible for that. And so I think it was trying to deal with my dream and what I hadn't yet achieved,
yeah,
coupled with, well, we're also in this state because of me and what we decided to do for me. So I think it was kind of all of it together more than anything.
It's a real reminder, isn't it, that when someone walks onto a tennis court, or when any professional athlete competes in their chosen sport, look at all the things you carry at that moment. You carry the thoughts of the 8-year-old, you carry the sacrifices of your parents, the hopes of your grandparents and your friends who you know are watching on screen back home. So how do you channel all of that and block all of that out? Because it's not healthy. You don't play better tennis for all that baggage. You play worse, don't you? So what's the answer to dealing with that?
Well, I think that's where I got very lucky. I got very lucky because that's when I was introduced to Juan Cotto.
Yep.
Through him and my coach at the time, Esteban Carril, and it was during that period that we started to peel back the layers of anxiety, of responsibility, of guilt. I think guilt is probably the biggest one. And start finding the root of why I play. And that's when I think the dream came back into it. That's where kind of I play because I fell in love with this sport as a young girl and I decided to dedicate my life to it. And whether I make it, I'm, you know, using quotation marks, whether I make it or not, it's actually irrelevant to that part because I, you know, I'm here and I'm trying to do the best that I can.
Yeah.
And I think taking a lot of joy and pride in me doing the best that I can, I think that's what started then alleviating the guilt and that side and actually started making room to become a better tennis player, to become a better competitor, to study the game, to learn the game, to actually maximize what I have as an athlete.
Would you say that you then started to love winning as opposed to fear losing? Was that a distinction that you began to make?
I think so, but I think more than anything, I just started to love playing and I started to actually almost fall in love again with the different things it offered me, an outlet of my competitiveness, of my curiosity to improve, my desire to learn. And I started enjoying that process. I think process became a very big trigger word for us. It was about the day in, day out process and enjoying that process.
So had you worked with anyone from a psychological perspective before you met Juan?
Yeah, I think kind of through the Australian Federation at the time and even maybe when I came over, I'm sure I'd met with someone at the LTA as well. I think psychology and sports psychology has always kind of been around for me. I think I came at the point where it started becoming more popular, but I think it was more it was when I met Juan where I found someone who just spoke to me in a way that I understood and I could grasp and I could use practically.
So could you give me an example of that then, Jo?
So it was kind of with him that we started first establishing a routine as well, an accountability for the things that I was doing. So I remember I'd always read every morning the Optimist's Creed. And if probably pushed hard enough, I probably could recite it still because I read that
for
years.
Come on, give us a bit.
No. And it would be things like, that's when I started using Headspace.
Yeah.
The app Headspace and kind of getting a practice into that. Then I think it was also working through different worries. So that's when I started writing. So writing down kind of what I was stressed about. And then there was a formula to that in writing down what I was struggling with. Bringing all the reasons in why that was okay, why that was normal, then bringing all the reasons in why it could be grateful and why actually everything's okay. And it's almost like a game plan for yourself with whatever you're struggling with on that day. And it was this kind of habit that we built. And I think that started, again, creating space for me to then play when it came to on court.
We get a lot of people talking to us about the struggle of anxiety and the baggage that they carry. And it seems to me like Juan kind of unpicked a lot of things from the past and realigned things in your mind. But almost more than that, it sounds like he kind of said, look, it's okay to have anxiety and struggle and fear and to carry all of this. But you can also carry it without being impacted by it. You can live with it.
Yeah? Yes. Yeah, I think it was understanding that actually whatever feelings that I'm feeling, whatever, however overwhelmed I feel, I'm actually fully equipped to deal with it. I'm fully equipped to live through it. And I think it was with him that we also discussed that nothing's permanent. Nothing's a permanent state. Everything keeps moving. And so I think that kind of gave me hope as well when I was feeling really down or overwhelmed, stressed, upset, anything. Knowing that this is not going to stay like this. I will feel different at some point. And I think actually let me just get it right in my head, but a formula that he gave me is pain times resistance equals suffering. So if I'm in pain, let's say at a 10, and I'm, you know, resisting at a 10, my suffering's going to be 100.
Yeah.
But if my resistance is zero, then my suffering's zero. And although, you know, there's probably variances in there, but to me that gave it a very practical, tangible kind of kind of steps for me to take if I was feeling a certain way.
So when did you see the evidence of this work that you were doing, the habit, some of the reflections that you were doing? When did you start to see some of the seeds of that begin to blossom?
I think probably in 2015, I was playing a small challenger circuit. I was also working with a coach who worked with Esteban called Jose Manuel Garcia, and he would sometimes come on trips with me. And we were together in the US playing on green clay. It was the kind of the prep circuit on the ITF tour for French Open. And we were playing 25s and maybe a $50,000 tournament in Jackson, Mississippi, and in Birmingham, Alabama,
yeah,
and Dothan, Alabama, I think the place was called. And I remember just playing that whole trip, just really grateful and really just kind of in a, yeah, in a very sincerely grateful way of just being able to be there and just to be able to step on court and being healthy and enjoying the sunshine and just really looking at these, you know, lovely little like clubs that we were playing at, like, how great is this? Yeah. How, and I think that's when I really felt like I took just a like a really big breath and just kind of, oh, this is really great. And if it never changes from this, if this is all I get in kind of the hierarchy of tennis, then my God, I'm so lucky. And I think it was that kind of just real deep appreciation for kind of what I was doing. Just it just brought me joy.
Brilliant.
I just started being very happy. And that was actually, to be fair, not too long before I then qualified for the first time at the French Open. And it was then that kind of back end of that summer that I went on a decent winning streak. I won the 100K in Vancouver and then qualified and made second week of
the US. So then when you started going to the big opens and the French Open,
yeah,
how much did you manage to still retain that attitude of gratitude, that appreciation of what you were experiencing there?
I think I still managed to bring that. I think through a bit of naivety as well. I'd never really experienced the big tournaments, big stages. I played, you know, a couple rounds here, and I'd qualified once before at the US Open. So I dabbled, I'd say, but it wasn't my routine stomping ground. It wasn't kind of my week in, week out. So I went into those tournaments feeling very trusting of the team that I had. I felt very grateful for the people that I had around me, and I think that definitely gave me a lot of strength at that time when I maybe didn't have my own to draw from as much. I think I did, but maybe a little bit cautiously, a bit nervously, kind of, oh, this is me, but it's okay, like this, like, so kind of almost like not fully like opening myself, oh, this is amazing kind of thing to that bit. I think that comes also with time, I think, on different stages.
That's fascinating. And
I assume that Juan actually was really helpful for you then away from tennis, because what he hasn't done is told you how to play a better backhand or how to be better at the net. These are life lessons that he was really giving you.
No, exactly. And it wasn't just even for me. It was at the time he was doing work with my parents. I think it was to understand the dynamic of kind of a whole mindset and whole kind of, you know, struggles. That it's also in the family. It's I wasn't the only one on that journey. My parents were as well, and they had their own, you know, things that they struggled with or they needed to understand. And I know he helped them a lot in perspective and kind of also understanding what I was going through. So it was a very nurturing environment. It was very holistic. It wasn't about performance. It was about living. It was about being a rounded human being. And
I suppose in some ways I know, of course, all that really matters is winning games of tennis, but actually when he improves that side of your life, it takes the pressure off the results, because you're not getting your happiness from winning games of tennis anymore. He's teaching you the tools for happiness, whatever the situation, whatever the tournament, whatever the result.
No, exactly. It was life lessons. It was about teaching me to, yeah, find joy in my life regardless of tennis, because there's going to be a life after tennis as well, and that's actually a lot longer, hopefully, knock on wood, than life before. And I think it was just that understanding of me as a human being is actually, that is what gives me a chance to be a tennis player, but that is actually who you have to nurture to give the tennis player even a chance.
So we get lots of parents listening to this podcast, Sanjo. So what was the big difference you noticed in your parents when they started to receive this advice?
I think kind of like me, I think there was a period where they also just kind of took a deep breath as well. You know, it's a very high stress environment where everyone's really trying so hard to achieve one goal. And it's kind of like they also, I think, found a way to give themselves some space from how I was doing or, you know, my tennis. And they kind of, I think they saw the people that I was surrounded by and they chose to trust them. And I think that gave them some peace as well, some peace and quiet probably within themselves as well. It was just that perspective and deep breath, and perspective is actually a really useful tool.
So take me into like the dynamic of, say, after a loss or a defeat, how did your parents then start to treat you in those moments?
I think it started becoming more about the effort again, more about, did I try my best?
Yeah.
I did. Well, then we keep going, we keep trying. And less about judgment, more about opportunity, I think, less about kind of insecurities, more about kind of a plan and knowing what we're working on and kind of seeing the progress in little things.
Yeah.
They bought into the whole process of learning and becoming better, and trusted that if it was going to give me success, it will, and give that time.
Because that's powerful, because you hear a lot of like horror stories of some of the parents of young prodigies on the tennis circuit that have sacrificed everything like your parents did, but then become fixated on the outcome. So how did that help you, the fact that your parents then started to engage in the process rather than worrying about the outcome?
I mean, I think quite frankly, if they didn't go on that journey with me, I probably wouldn't have been able to make it, because I needed their help and their guidance for me to be able to do it as well, because we were in this together, and it was, I was 24, but I was very young. I was, you know, I'd only ever lived at home, albeit I traveled the world a lot. And so, you know, it was still at the kind of end stages of me growing up and starting to become more of an adult, but it's kind of, we needed to do this together for us to have a better relationship kind of on the court to do with tennis, but also off it. So I couldn't have done it without them also committing to it.
And they wouldn't have been able to do that without the help of Juan Cotto. And the real tragedy here for people that are listening to this that don't know the story of your relationship with Juan was that he sadly took his own life. And I wonder how difficult that was for you personally, because when someone's giving you life advice, you look at them and think, wow, if only I was as sorted as you are, if only if I knew all the things that you know, I would have had a very different path to here. It's hard to know what to ask, really, but that is a very hard thing for you to compute, I'd imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you know what's interesting? I think actually people that give the best advice and actually really understand something is because they have personal experience. And I knew that he had struggled with his own thoughts and his own emotional, mental well-being before, and he's spoken about that with me. And I think it was kind of that journey for himself that he saw the power in thinking, in the mind, in emotion. And I think, you know, I mean, how incredibly passionate he was about helping people. Yeah. I think the two together made into an incredible human being. And, you know, it, Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I, yeah, no, he was amazing.
Yeah, I bet. And I suppose the irony is, without his own personal struggles, he wouldn't have been in the position to help people like you and to transform people's lives. And, you know, we've all lost people close to us. I think that perhaps the lessons that he gave you live longer and live stronger for the fact that he's no longer here to see them.
You know, I mean, I'd love if he was still here. I think yeah. The lessons will still be just as strong, but for reasons we know, we don't know, life yeah. turned out the way it did. And but I know that he would be very proud in I think knowing that the things that he was teaching people, not just myself, but he touched a lot of people's lives, are still giving guidance and bringing joy to people, and I think that would make him very happy.
And you work hard to remember the things he taught you, because we had a guest on called Jo Malone, who created the perfume brand. Yeah. She had a cancer diagnosis, and she said that when she had the diagnosis, she was going to change the way she lived. And then after she recovered, she found that the lessons, she said, slipped through my fingers like sand, and she couldn't catch them anymore. What do you do now to remember the lessons that Juan taught you to make sure that they don't slip through your fingers?
Well, I think because of the way he taught me and the way he guided me, it was a very practical way. It was me doing the work. It was routine. And because I figured it out for myself in the end with his help, actually, the biggest gift that he gave is that the work is mine, the result is mine, the experience is mine, and therefore I always have the ability to think back on it and create space to really, okay, what have I learned? And that's the gift he gave me. It's actually, he didn't do it for me. He guided me in a way that I could do it for myself. And that means that it's a part of me, and it's not something that I'll lose. I think it was kind of that.
It was powerful.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Can I ask a question that I've asked a number of guests on this? How much improvement, if you had to put a figure on it, do you think working on the psychology and the mental side of your sport gave you?
I think for me, it was a massive part, because for me, I think I was always relatively gifted as an athlete. I've got a good physique for what I do. I've got good genes in that sense. You know, I think I have the ability to work hard. I had fundamentals that could make me a good athlete, could make me a good tennis player. And I think that got me to a certain point. But I think without that mental aspect on just helping me to deal with my own crap, really, yeah. Without that opportunity, I don't think I would have gone from A to B. I think I would have been stuck where I was.
So when you're now at the big opens and things like that, I imagine that most people have got a similar level of fitness, strength, their technique is relatively similar. How much then do you think the mental side of tennis decides who gets into those later rounds?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big part of what we do. It's a big part of our sport, of most sports. But our matches can be long. It's a bit of chess. It's a bit of, so, you know, 100% I think it's a part of, but I think it's the mental side is kind of like a forehand or a backhand. It's another part that everyone's looking to maximize, and everyone is becoming more and more self-aware, knowing their triggers or knowing okay, how do I react in these situations? Yeah. Okay, what thoughts can I think on to help me kind of stay in the moment, stay grounded, stay present. Kind of everyone's starting to become aware. So it's actually becoming less of a factor,
okay,
just because I think more people are aware of it. So it starts becoming the 1% in kind of, it's starting to become another shot, essentially, I think.
It's a good point, that though, when not many people are doing it, focusing on the mental side of something is really valuable.
It's revolutionary.
When everyone's doing it, you have to be extra good at that to be any better, don't you?
But then the reason that I asked that question is because I read the quote that said that you didn't have huge levels of emotional control in those early days. You didn't almost have a plan B when times got tough. So how do you spot now that maybe you're starting to lose emotional control that could potentially cost you a game, or that you need to change a game plan?
I think now it's knowing myself better. Yeah. I think part of, I guess, losing emotional control, or I think part of that is also immaturity.
Do you agree with those?
Not necessarily, not fully. Yeah. Just because I think a lot of it is context. A lot of it is also, it's understanding what's going on, and people lose their shit kind of every day in different walks of life. And the only thing that's different is being in a heightened state,
yep,
in front of loads of people. Mm. It becomes kind of that much more like, whoa, she's really kind of lost her head. And it's not always the case, I think. I don't like it when I think, you know, you hear these hyperbolic words of like, kind of, they've completely lost control, they're out of it, or, you know, let things happen, let things move. But for sure, for me personally, I needed to find a space where I could channel and could start reorganizing my thoughts when I became stressed, yeah, or when I became so-called emotional.
So how do you do that then?
Perspective. That's where actually perspective became a big part of actively doing it during matches. It was kind of taking a step back and saying, the sun's shining, my family loves me, I'm out here, I'm getting a good tan.
Yeah.
I'm staying physically fit. I get to do something that I love. what's the problem?
And you'll run through that in your head, will you, during the match, in between a
more
serve,
so,
or in between
yeah,
a set,
more so
or whatever?
Then, yeah. I think less so now, just because I think it's maybe become a little bit more oiled, a little bit easier. But yeah, then I would actually just really go through different things, like just kind of gratefulness and perspective.
So do you remember a few years ago when Andy Murray brought out a letter that he'd written to himself of all his strengths and characteristics?
I think
and
I
people
do, yeah.
saw that. Do you have anything like that, any props or anything to help you trigger that sense of perspective?
No, but back in 2016 at the Australian Open at the time, at the top of tennis rackets, on the top of the grip, there's that little band that kind of holds the sticky tape in place, that holds the grip kind of in place. And I got to have like different colors of that little kind of band thing, and it had different words on there, and it had like play, it had love, it had power, it had focus. And actually that to me I really enjoyed it, and I would purposely choose a different one for each match that I played at the Australian Open that year. And I kind of would look at it sometimes and think, you know what, I can practice like this is something I can use. Like I just kind of, so I don't know if that answers your question, but I just remember that kind of felt like
it's perfect. Yeah, it's actually a good reminder that, you know, people think that to change your mindset or to get control of your brain is a really big job and it's nigh on impossible. The reality is it can be something as simple as looking at a colour, looking at a word, looking at the sunshine, thinking about your parents. You know, little things can have such a huge impact, can't they?
No, I think so. And I think, you know, it's again coming back to that realisation that whatever difficulty you're facing, whatever heaviness you have, it's not permanent. It can change. Mm. And actually all the tools that you need are within you or in your environment. And it can be sights, sounds, smells, your own kind of feel, like, you know, you have the ability to live through it and to go through it and change it. And yeah,
from my conversation I get the sense that one of your frustrations is people passing judgment on a match you've played or the way a match has gone. I mean, we have to accept we live in a world of no nuance, right? So you are either brilliant or awful. There's nothing in between. Let's just accept that is the way the world works these days. Have you learned to not fight against people casting judgment over what happened during a match when they have basically no idea what happened because they weren't out on the court? Or do you just accept it now? How do you deal with those things? Do you fight them?
No. I don't. I understand what it is and the place it has. I think as a logical person, I get that. I think when it becomes difficult is when you're tired, when you're feeling vulnerable, when you're feeling sad. That's when it's harder to do. It's harder to practice that practical mind, and that's when it can affect you. That's when it can kind of creep in and kind of jab you a little bit, and that's when you take it on. So yes, I know how to deal with it, and I get it. Does it always happen that I deal with it that way? No. Sometimes I get upset by it. Sometimes I cry about the injustice of it. Sometimes, or sometimes I don't care. Sometimes it's fine. Sometimes, well, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but sometimes it's how dare they have that opinion. So, you know, I think it's also on what state you're in and kind of how much things are affecting you. But again, perspective.
So as you probably know, I work, you know, as a sports presenter. Like, what are the questions or what are the things that we should be doing when it comes to people like you that educate the audience better rather than just guessing that you've lost your shit or you've mentally collapsed or whatever? What should we be asking people like you to really understand what goes on in games and in events?
I think it's individual, but I think it's more listening to what we say. I think for me, I actually do try consciously to give an insight, not just for the journalists, but for the people who are reading the pieces. And I do try to actually get my personality across, my beliefs across, my thought process across, like kind of who am I as a player? Who am I as a person? And I think what's most frustrating maybe is when the answer you give, they don't like, or they want something different. And it's more the case of, well, I can't give you anything different because this is who I am. And so work with me then, because I can't be anything other than me. Yep. And I think it's more that's for me is where my frustration more comes from, is I'm trying to let you know who I am, you know, play ball with me here, because I like talking, I like sharing my experiences. I've been very open in the work that I've done with Juan, with you know, people in the past, especially on the mental side, and I think I don't have any hang-ups about sharing.
Well, there's 8-year-old Johanna Contas living somewhere in the world, dreaming of being the world number one. So the lessons that you can share, you know, are only a good thing. It's been a really interesting sort of journey to go from running up hills with your dad to leaving home to crying with your mum because your career wasn't going the way you wanted, to having your eyes opened by Juan to actually the fact that the power is all yours. And then we get to the point where suddenly, like, you're in the top 5 best tennis players in the world, and you are the British number one, and you are in that place that you dreamed of as a little kid, carrying the hopes of an entire nation at Wimbledon. Was it all you hoped it would be?
Oh, yes and no. Yes, it is lots of people around you. Yes, it is exciting. But actually, you go home and it's very normal.
Yeah.
So it's not... it's not everything you thought it would be. It's actually a lot better because it's just your life and it's normal and it's nothing actually changes. And I remember actually in 2017, because I think that's what you're referring to, yeah. I remember playing the matches, and I remember feeling nervous or stressed or it was difficult. And I remember kind of, you know, looking up in the stands and just looking at my boyfriend there and thinking, well, actually, after this, we'll go home and you'll still love me and whatever happens here. And you know, it was kind of that normality of kind of being with that. And I think that's why it's actually so much better than what you dream of. For me, it was anyway, just because it's just normal.
And that's when you were playing some of your best ever tennis. So it shows that you don't have to be struggling. Johnny Wilkinson spoke on this podcast about he thought that struggling would lead to success, and he realised that struggling just leads to more struggling. And
yes,
this is really interesting, that just as you were at the absolute peak, you weren't having to struggle, you were kind of free.
Yeah, no, I think I was. And I think actually I would call it my biggest year of freedom probably was in 2019. And that's when I started working with Dmitry Zabialov, and he's been an incredible influence on my life. And the... you know, perspectives then he started bringing into then my tennis, and kind of again giving me the kind of the control of how do you want to play, what do you want to do out there, kind of the what choices do you want to make, and trust those choices. They're, you know, they're, if they don't pay dividends, then who knows in how they pay dividends in other parts of the match. It was kind of understanding that, you know, there's no right or wrong, there's you know, things again keep moving. But yeah, and actually that year I played very free that year.
So what you're describing there, what Dmitry's doing, is the idea of guided discovery, that he's allowing you to answer the questions, he's just posing them, which sounds obvious in many ways. How common is that approach within your world?
I think it's very uncommon.
Uncommon.
I'd say it's uncommon. Because it takes trust and faith in I think a path less kind of walked, less discovered. You know, there's still a lot of success and a lot of good things in the kind of you do what you're told. You know, there's a lot of good coaches out there who've worked with a lot of great players who together they've done that. But I don't function like that, and I think it's all very individual. So for me, this kind of work, this way of working, is actually, I think, the only way I can perform, I can bring the best out of myself. So for me, it was very important, but no, it's not common.
Well, because it sounds very similar to the approach that your dad took when you first declared that you wanted to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and run, that you're dictating the terms and conditions rather than somebody's got a stick and beating you to get out there.
And who knows, maybe there's some subconscious kind of way of that's how I was wired when I was young, so maybe that's why that kind of working as an adult works for me. I don't know, but I didn't think of that. So yes, you're right.
it all comes back. Yeah. But I suppose I'm kind of thinking that the Johan Konta that's sitting in front of us today is so different to the 21, 22-year-old who was totally outcome-focused. Yeah. You're probably realising now that actually the outcome is it's the journey, not the outcome, right?
Yeah. No, 100%. And I think that was actually one of the biggest things that I wrote always consistently is, I you know, I'm committed to the process. I'm enjoying the process and the outcome will be what it will be. Mm. It's not that it's kind of here. Yeah. And I think actually my fitness trainer said this, and I probably won't use the I can't remember the exact words, but it was basically along the lines of, you know, there's winning and losing and the highs and the lows, but actually then there's living. Mm. You know, we live every day and it's make that living purposeful and enjoyable and you want to come to work with the people that you enjoy working with, and because, you know, winning, losing, it's kind of here, there, it's high, it's low, it's, but in between all that, there's actually just living every day.
And is that quite scary when you've spent a whole life being focused on the goal, on the outcome? Someone actually saying to you, no, let's not think about winning the tournament, let's just think about enjoying playing in the tournament. Because whether it's a CEO or a teacher or a parent listening to this, to shift their mindset away from the result is, I think, is scary.
Yes, but actually to me it was liberating. I needed it. I think I was starved for it. I needed, because I was doing it one way and it wasn't making me happy. It wasn't making me successful. It was actually making me downright miserable. It was making my parents miserable. Like it wasn't working. So actually, what was the harm for me? For me, it was, why not? And I just took to it because I understood it. I understood it very quickly and I could see it, like kind of what joy could bring me. And then, hey, I'm happy. Why? You know, what's there to kind of complain about?
So can you tell us about the transferability of that mindset, though, about letting go of the result and focusing on the process to a world outside of tennis?
I think it's completely transferable because I've used it in different things. So, you know, for me, getting used to even this, for example, you know, I probably would get more nervous before than I would now, just because I understand that I will come here, I will do the best that I can, and I will enjoy speaking to you both, and the result will be what it will be, and I will keep my fingers crossed that, you know, I give you guys a good episode, but at the end of the day, I can only be myself, and I can only do the best that I can. So I think it's that you can apply in anything. And I was actually the other day, I just did Sunday brunch and I was really nervous before going on. I don't know why, but I felt very, very nervous. And again, it's just that same process of, okay, I'm here, I'm on time, I've done everything that I can, I will go out there, I'll be kind, I'll be happy, and we'll see what happens.
I think this episode will be okay, don't you?
I think it'll be exceptional. Bit of editing.
We've reached the point of our quickfire questions that we always finish the podcast with. First of all, the three non-negotiable behaviours that you and the people around you have to buy into.
Respectful. Mm-hmm. I think being honest. Honesty. That's the word. Honesty. And communication. Fine. To communicate.
What advice would you give to a teenage Johanna just starting out?
I wish I learnt earlier on to just be grateful and be patient and look at the world more broadly, look at my career more broadly. I think, you know, it's very narrow, it's very all-encompassing, kind of stop and smell the roses kind of thing. Yeah.
Lovely.
Stop and smell the roses.
Very good. Could you give one book recommendation for our high-performance family to have a read of?
It's Winning Not Fighting. No, yeah, Winning Not Fighting by John Vincent.
Excellent. Why does that book work for you?
I actually just started it, to be honest, and I'm just really interested in reading kind of the philosophy that I've bought into, but a different take on it, because it's not maybe quite word for word what I kind of maybe learned. But it's definitely along the same lines, or certain bits that I've read, like they are definitely. So it's just nice to hear how someone else has also practically used it in their life.
Very good.
What's your one golden rule for a high performance life?
I think practicing joy, practicing gratefulness. I think that gives you the chance to be your best self and therefore your best chance of being successful.
Brilliant. And there is one more. This is the final
yes.
question. What is your biggest strength and what is your biggest weakness?
My biggest strength, my biggest strength is I laugh a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's helped me in a lot of different things. My biggest weakness is probably being able to take a break. That's taken some time for me to know kind of when to apply myself, but when to also kind of take a bit of space, nurture myself, take some time off. That's something that I've had to learn and continue to learn.
Brilliant. Look, thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
Thank you.
And especially for opening up and talking to us about Juan, which I know wouldn't have been very easy for you. But I think that, like, to get from the 8-year-old to being a professional tennis player, right, you had to be all in. You kind of, at that point, you had to totally be all about the outcome. And I think what's been really powerful in this conversation is sharing with us the journey from being outcome-focused to process-focused. And it's worked for you in a tennis sense, but I really hope that for everyone listening to this, it works for them in the sense of their own lives as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. No, thank you for having me.
Damien.
Jake.
Another really interesting interview. You know what? I think people listen to this and they're looking for really huge things that could be said that will change their lives and alter the way they see the world. What Johanna has just basically said there is that a tiny detail, focusing on the process, gaining perspective, can change everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just to take us with her onto the centre court at Wimbledon and remember to look around and see a boyfriend and remember that in a couple of hours' time you'll be back at home together and everything will be normal, or appreciate just the sun shining on your back at any stage. They're techniques that any of us can appreciate at any moment, just the ability to live in the moment and stop worrying about the outcome and just focus on the moment that we're in.
And also, I think don't underappreciate just how important those little things can be. And there will definitely be people listening to this now going, you put up a slogan at work, is it really going to change the way people think? Or you write a little note in your notebook, is that really going to alter the way someone operates daily? We've just had someone who is the best tennis player in Britain, was number 4 in the world, and at that time had the word love or appreciation or power or focus written on her tennis racket, and at times of struggle just looked at that word, and that was enough for her to push through, persevere and win that game of tennis. If you can use that technique at the absolute highest echelon in world sport, everyone can use it.
Absolutely. It's like just like a trigger that just prompts you to connect with the emotions, the thoughts, the feelings that you have when you're happy, when you're experiencing what Joe described as her golden rule, just joy. Any moments that connect you to that have got to then help you feel better and ultimately perform better.
She reminded me quite a lot of Johnny Wilkinson, the way she spoke when he came on the podcast.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. Johnny came to some of those realisations at the end of his career, and I found what fascinating what Joe shared was she's discovered it halfway through her career, and that's what's propelled her to the heights that she's reached.
It's interesting because I think a lot of professional sports people would think, well, I can't have that growth mindset now. I'm too focused on being a sports person. The growth mindset is what's made her a successful sports person. And when you sit and have a conversation like we did with her, I mean, clearly her parents were brilliant, the way that they inspired her and pushed her. But then I think she probably did go into this quite dark and difficult period of struggling with her tennis, and her tennis was what was defining her. Now it's clearly not what defines her. So I kind of get the sense that she is much better equipped for what lies ahead of her tennis career, because, you know, she will have 40 or 50 years on the earth not being a tennis player, and she seems like she's sorted for that period.
Absolutely. I think that's a really powerful message, that she's not defined by just what she does out there on the court. She's defined by the person that those experiences have shaping her to be, and she can only realise that by appreciating the process and not the outcome. There'll be hundreds of tennis players out there that will never win an Open, that will never win a tournament. So does that make them lesser people? than the champions? Well, if you focused on the process, the answer to that is very clearly not.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Thank you, mate.
Well, I reckon you may well have needed a pen and paper for that. I found it a really emotional conversation at numerous points, and I finished that conversation, as you heard me saying, with Damien at the end, with a lot to think about. But I feel like our guest is in such a good place mentally, and there's no doubt that if you're a professional athlete, over time, your physical prowess melts away. But if you can make sure that mentally you're strong, then you're in a good place. And I left that conversation just feeling excited for her future. So thank you so much to Johanna Konta for coming on the High Performance Podcast and being so honest with us and sharing so many things that I think some people who are at their very peak of their careers wouldn't necessarily be willing to share. But once again, it's a reminder of the power of these kinds of conversations where we give it time and we really get to the root of what you at home want to hear so that you can improve your own lives. I'm not sure there's anything else out there like this at the moment. And I'm so grateful that you're all part of the journey with us. If you'd like to get even more from us, of course, we also have a members club called the High Performance Circle. More podcasts, more inspirational talks, more keynote speeches, newsletters, offers, giveaways. It's a great club and it's free to be a member. All you have to do is go to thehighperformancepodcast.com and sign up for the High Performance Circle. So that's it from our Olympic specials. Thanks to all of our brilliant guests. And don't forget, you can also roll back into the High Performance Archives because of the 6 most successful Olympians that Britain has ever produced. 3 of them have now been on the podcast. Jason Kenny, Sir Chris Hoy, and Tom Daly as well. And I reckon it may well be Sir Tom Daly and Sir Jason Kenny before too long. Right, we're back with another episode next week. But from all of us on the High Performance Podcast, from Hannah, from Will, from Professor Damien Hughes, from myself, Finn Ryan at Rethink Audio, we can't thank you enough for being part of the conversation that we're having right here. Keep your thoughts coming into us. Ping us some messages on Instagram. We love to hear from you. But most of all, take what you've learned, really use it to uplift, build, and push your own life forwards. Have a brilliant High Performance Day. Lots of love.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.